You're listening to an IOE podcast,
powered by UCL Minds.
Welcome to the ECF staff room. I'm Elaine Long.
And I am Mark Quinn.
We are programme leaders for the UCL Early Career Teacher Development Programme. Why are we in the staff room? We are here because this is where the best professional learning conversations always take place. This is where problems can be aired bluntly and where solutions can be explored.
Over the course of this series, we will hear the voices of different colleagues as they come into the ECF staff room. We will hear from early career teachers themselves and from the mentors and induction tutors who support them. We will talk about all things ECF, the challenges and the joys. So why don't you enjoy a coffee with us, perhaps even grab a biscuit and sit down to half an hour of ECF staff room chat. Welcome to the ECF staff room, Jan Rowe. It's really, really nice to see you, Jan, and to have you in our staff room. We are at one of those staff rooms where we're really happy to make a hot drink or a cold drink for a new guest in our staff room, tea or coffee, whatever you might like. What do you take when you walk into a staff room?
Oh, I take very strong white coffee.
That's kind of contradiction in terms, isn't it?
Well, I suppose so. You know, with just a dash of milk, but I'm kind of known here for the strength of my coffee and how I can manage to keep going. Probably shouldn't on so many cups of coffee a day.
and if we threw in a biscuit, what would it be?
Oof! If it was a biscuit, it would probably be a ginger nut, I think. Yeah.
I haven't had a ginger nut in I don't know how long.
Good for dunking.
We'll definitely find one of those in the back of the cupboard.
I was just going to say, Janet, excellent for dunking ginger nuts. That's mm-hmm. my top choice of biscuit mm-hmm. as well. And we're really grateful for you coming into the staff room because we know you have such a huge wealth of expertise in teaching and also teacher development. And we know our listeners will be really keen to find out about what you do and what an average day is like for you. So would you mind just introducing yourself for our listeners?
Yeah, so I work at Liverpool John Moores University in Liverpool, and my current role is Strategic Partnership Development Lead. I was previously the Head of Initial Teacher Education here, but this year I chose to step down and work part-time in a slightly more partnership-focused role. So my main responsibility here now is to support our school direct provision, which is we're trying to maintain into the longer term because it's one of the policy moves that's perhaps more contentious is to stop school direct as a named route into teaching. So I work with our school direct partners, with our SCIT partners, but also my kind of main area of responsibility in terms of development is working alongside colleagues on that really crucial interface between our school-based partners and the university-based programs to try and properly integrate across our big partnership of about 200 schools, 600 students, a kind of deep knowledge and understanding of the curriculum that we're offering and how we can all contribute purposefully to the success of the students that we're working with.
Really interesting, and it'll be particularly interesting to talk to you about how you see both sides of that, where you've got a strong knowledge of schools and what they need, and also then how universities can best support them with that. And I'm well aware that your career didn't start there, and every educator has a story about how they entered the profession and how it developed. Would you mind telling us a bit about yours?
Yeah, so I began my kind of teaching career as a modern languages teacher. So I came to Liverpool to train to teach for personal reasons, really, and was only intending to stay a year. I did my PGCE at the University of Liverpool and I've never left. So that's, you know, over 30 years, three very scouse children later. I'm still here, and my entire teaching career and teacher education career has been based in Liverpool. So yeah, I taught for about 7 years, became a secondary head of languages in a comprehensive school in the city. Then I became the advisory teacher for languages, then the languages advisor in days when such things existed. I remember as part of that role having to introduce the national curriculum to teachers. So I'm that old. And then I moved into teacher education at another institution in the city, first of all, and then I've been at Liverpool John Moores for about 10 years. So I've worked in teacher education, initial teacher education, for about 20 years now.
Well, you definitely don't look old enough, Jan, to experience all of that. What do you enjoy most about working in teacher education?
I mean, I still really enjoy the commitment, the enthusiasm, the ethical values of the young and not so young people that come into teaching. It's an absolute joy to meet them at the beginning of every year. One of the things I used to do when I was head of ITU was to go into every single introductory session with every group of students and welcome them to teaching and thank them for being committed enough to become teachers. So, you know, seeing that kind of squad arrive at the beginning of the year and then seeing them leave and go out into the profession, I've never lost that absolute commitment to the importance of teaching, and talk up the people that come into teaching as much as I can, because I think there's a tendency, I was talking to a head teacher about this morning, for it all to be seen as gloom and doom and some kind of last resort. And it's by no means a last resort for the young, you know, the students that we work with. And, you know, I suppose it's in my kind of, you know, my down my spine, really. My mum was a teacher. I was a teacher. My eldest child is a teacher. So yeah, I would never put people off it. I mean, I don't run away from the fact that it's hard, but I think it's still such a rewarding thing to do. And I think that the thing that I've always found really interesting about teaching that doesn't often get talked about is what it does to people as people. So, you know, I think people have this sense that confident people become teachers. I've seen lots of people come into teaching that are not confident at all, and through teaching become confident. So I think one of the under-celebrated things about teaching is what it does to you as a person, not just as a professional.
That's really interesting, Jan. I think that might have happened to me, actually. I think before I started teaching, yeah. I wouldn't have dreamt of standing up in front of groups of people, but I think teaching gave me that thing that gave me that sense of belonging and actual enjoyment. But yeah, I've never heard anyone really talk about it like that. That's already really made me think about development. It's really interesting.
Yeah, that's a great line, actually. What teaching does to people as people. Jan, you know, we're 20 years, did you say, in initial teacher education, and working as you do with a couple of hundred schools in the Liverpool area. I'm just thinking, we're curious as to what you think about how those young people and not so young people entering the profession today are different or similar to the people who entered the profession 20 years ago. You know, have they changed? Are they the same? What would you say about that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think broadly people are the same, that, you know, people that come into teaching for the same reasons that people always came into teaching, you know, that genuine commitment to putting something back into society, to making a difference. And I always encourage people that come into teaching to say that, you know, it became a kind of thing that people felt they shouldn't say because it was naff. But, you know, if you don't come into teaching for those reasons, then, you know, you shouldn't really be in teaching. So I think the motivations to come into teaching are very similar. I suppose, you know, people that come into teaching now have a different experience of education themselves. And so that always has an impact on the kind of teachers that they envisage themselves coming, or what they see teaching as. And maybe there's more variability now, perhaps, in their prior experiences. But I think essentially, you know, there's many more similarities than differences.
Do you think their expectations are similar or different? You know, I'm just wondering because certainly when I became a teacher, I looked at the 40 years teacher pension and thought, okay, so that's it then, right? So that's the expectation. And I probably did imagine that I was going to be teaching that long. Or maybe I managed half of it, not the whole lot, but still. When we hear, don't we, that that's no longer the expectation of a young person going into, or an older person going into teaching. They don't expect to be in that long. Do you pick that up or not?
To be honest, I don't. And I'm not quite sure where that rumour's come from. You know, that people see it as a kind of temporary stop on the way to somewhere else. You know, that isn't the impression that we get from the students we work with. And, you know, I think their intention is to commit for the long term, you know, whether they do or they don't, whether they find other things that they decide to do instead. I don't think they set out thinking it's a short-term thing.
I don't. I think my suspicion, as you're probably right there, is that no one can think that teaching is an easy bag to carry, right? And if they ever did think that, just spending, you know, the first week in initial teacher education course would prove them wrong, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's a hard thing to go through. Yeah. No matter how nice you are, you know, it's a hard process, and you'll certainly expose what weaknesses you have. So I think you're probably right. If people, those who get through to the end of that and go into their first teaching job, even if they do leave earlier than we'd like them to, that's not how they imagine. That's not what they imagine is going to happen when they start. Yeah. That's interesting. And you said something about how their own schooling is maybe different nowadays to what it might have been 15, 20 years ago. Did you want to say anything more about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's only a kind of hunch, really. But I think, I mean, and it will vary from area to area. But I think, you know, there are some people coming into teaching now that have perhaps been through a schooling system that's a bit more rigid, or some schools where, you know, teachers are expected to act in a very similar way to each other. It seems like some of the kind of quirks and foibles of teaching have gone from some schools, but that's only a supposition. And I think one of the things that I think is very rich about a lot of teacher education programs, not exclusively university teacher education programs, is the diversity of schools that they get to see. Because, you know, for instance, we have quite a number of students that come to us from Northern Ireland. It's just the nature of being in Liverpool. We're the closest place for them to come if they want to train to teach in England. And most of them have been through the grammar school system in Northern Ireland, you know, so they're very unused to the diversity of a comprehensive, and it's a fantastic learning experience for them. But they're quite apprehensive at first because it's very alien to the experience that they've had themselves. So that's always interesting to watch. You know, they come because they want that experience, but they're nonetheless a bit scared about it initially.
I confess to the very same.
Yeah.
Jan, I'm just interested in your strategic work with schools. And so obviously you're in the privileged position of being able to go into different schools and look at the culture that they're creating around teacher development. And some of our own early research has suggested that with our own early career programme, the schools that really create a positive culture around teacher development are able to implement the programme much more successfully. Is that something that resonates with your experience as an ITE provider? And if so, well, what are those schools doing that create that really positive culture around teacher development?
Yeah, I mean, I think schools are very invested in teacher development, and certainly the commitment that they make to initial teacher education, I think, is extraordinary, given that, you know, it's largely unpaid and a voluntary role. And our mentors would say that one of the reasons they like it is because they feel that it develops their own learning, you know, in helping somebody else to learn. They're also learning themselves. And I think the schools that really get it right are the schools that don't have a one size fits all approach, that really listen to what individual members of staff are interested in developing, you know, and tailor make opportunities for them. I mean, I know every school has to have certain things that every teacher in the institution needs to be updated about and so on, or they'll have priorities that they think are there for everybody. But I think that ability to really consider and to give agency to teachers over their own next steps in learning is hugely important and something that not every school gets right, you know, and the happiest schools in terms of teachers feeling that they're lifelong learners and are being supported in that are the ones that really take into consideration what the teacher wants, not just what the school wants.
One of our real challenges is obviously that our ECTs come from different ITE providers, and because the landscape for ITE is so different, and what they learn on different programmes in different ways can be different. That is a real challenge for us in terms of making sure that they can all have that unique starting point. So there are a number of things we've done to mitigate that. And I think you're right. It is hugely important that every ECT gets to start from their own starting point, because they will be different depending on their levels of confidence, depending on the ITE route they've had, depending on their experiences of school placement. You know, there will be variability. In there, we do start the modules with audits for that reason, I think, so then they can adjust the balance of time. And one of the things we found in the early days, actually, I was horrified when I spoke to some ECTs, and they were saying we're spending 2 hours on our self-study, and Mark and I and the rest of the team were absolutely horrified, because we realised that these sort of hidden messages might have gone out there that they had to do that. But actually, you know, what I think you're absolutely right, Jan, what we want teachers to be doing is their time's absolutely precious. Their professional development has to be grippingly relevant, and it has to be useful, because I think whenever you're working with anyone in education, you have to understand you're working with time poor people. And so with time poor people, everything they do has to be relevant. So we did. Yeah, we did spend a long time sort of reflecting on that and thinking about how we could make that as good as we can within the limitations we have for ECT. Sorry, Mark, I interrupted you there. You were going to speak as well.
I was going to say something like that, but I think, Jan, you've given us good advice as well, which is that always look for those opportunities of things we can cut out if it's just burdensome, if it's just bureaucratic, if it's completely meaningless. I think we've done some of that, but there's always more. There's always room for more. You mentioned centralization of the curriculum. Some commentators talk, don't they, about kind of a bid to simplify teaching, you know, so we can see that, or at least some people say that that's what we've seen in some of the school reforms. Or we see it in the loss of authority from local government when it comes to input into education. Or sometimes we see it, don't we, with new teachers being handed their whole curriculum and say, right, that's what you do. You deliver that. You don't teach it. You deliver that. So there is that side of things that here are your what to do's, do those things and you'll be fine. And there's and people sometimes say that's the right thing to do, and other people say that's a terrible thing to do because you remove the ethical decision making that a teacher has to learn to make, and the humane or human aspects of being a teacher. Do you see those two things as binary, by the way, or do you see any merit in each side of that argument?
Yeah, I mean, like lots of things, it's been made much more binary than it needs to be. So, right. You know, it because you get that kind of argument from people that if you don't believe in giving everybody scripted lessons and lesson plans, then you're basically saying that everybody has to design everything from scratch, you know, and nobody's saying that, you know. I think I come back to talking to teachers and talking to student teachers and asking them, what is it that they like about teaching? Yeah. And one of the things that people like about teaching is deciding how to teach what they've got to teach. That doesn't mean writing copious lesson plans. You know, that's different, and people misinterpret that if they think that's what they're saying. But we all remember, don't we? And we still remember, you know, you in designing your curriculum, you'll be sitting there thinking, oh, that's a great way. Should we approach it that way? And what if we tried this, and what if we tried that, and what about that resource? And that's one of the great joys of teaching.
Yeah.
And if you take that away from people, I think you'll have fewer people coming into teaching.
And staying.
and staying, because you know, and as I say that, you know, it nobody needs to document those thoughts on silly pro formas and upload them to any platform. You know, that's there's a difference between planning a lesson and having a lesson plan, but that that agency. I mean, you know, as I said, our eldest, she's a teacher in London, and she's an English teacher, and if you took that away from her, the ability to kind of decide how she was going to teach the young people that she's teaching, and just told her to do it that way, I don't think she'd last long, because I you know, that's a nice part of the job. There are other bits of the job that teachers would much more be much more keen to get rid of than that, I think.
Yeah,
and that's researched. Oh, sorry, Mark.
Well, what could we get rid of that we make teachers do?
Well, I think there's too much still bureaucratic data dropping and onerous report writing, and you know, those kinds of things are still the things that get in the way of teachers and teaching. There's clearly an awful lot of pastoral care that young people need. And I don't think teachers would want not to be involved with that, but they need better support with, you know, particularly the kind of extreme, you know, difficulties that the children and young people they're working alongside have. So, you know, I think it's fascinating the ways in which teachers aren't asked. you know, we've got a great population that, you know, it's like whenever a teacher leaves teaching, there should be some kind of standard form that they have to fill in that says, why have you left? You know, and then we'd know. We're often speculating, aren't we, about why people have left? So, yeah, I mean, I think my answer to a lot of things would be let's ask teachers, you know, and maybe some of the schools that have got it right are the schools that do just that. They ask their teachers, you know, and then they listen to it properly and they do something about it. So, you know, they ask them about well-being in a really purposeful way, rather than saying, you know, stay behind after school on Monday for a yoga session, you know, when people are just thinking, actually, I'd rather go home. So, it's about having that conversation, I think. And one of the things I really love about the job that I do is about that. It's about that listening to schools, working with schools, trying to be respectful of what each one brings. The thing that's kept me in teacher education for as long as I've been in it has been partnership. And how do you really ethically, morally grow a partnership where everybody feels invested and listened to and respected? Because, you know, when I first came into ITE, I've been in it long enough to remember when partnership became a thing. So Circular 498, you know, was partnership. You know, we were suddenly in a partnership model. But it wasn't really a partnership. It was universities telling the schools what they wanted them to do. And I think we've come a long way since then. I actually think one of the reasons why I feel very strongly about School Direct is I think that's been a big vehicle for really bringing partnership into a space that really is properly partnership. It's enabled those schools to really understand what IT is all about. And actually, they've come to realise that it's much more complex than they thought it was. And universities to really think carefully about whether they're properly listening to schools. So, again, it's, you know, the bit that excites me is that kind of interface. It's like the Venn diagram. I want to be in the middle bit and improve the middle bit.
Yeah, I think it's because we've learned, if we didn't know it before, maybe we learned it with that circular you mentioned, Jan, but what partnership does is it makes something at least of the collective wisdom of the profession, rather than assuming that all the wisdom lies in one place. And you might be surprised to hear us say this, because we are, you know, a leader of a big national program of ECF, and, you know, we wrote it and therefore you do it. That's actually doesn't feel like that to us, because you mentioned our local partner up in Liverpool is a major player for us, you know, and we wouldn't be in Liverpool if it wasn't for them, and we wouldn't be in Devon if it wasn't for our partners down there. We wouldn't be anywhere in the country. Mm-hmm. We celebrate that as much as we can. We listen a lot. They push us around. You know those people in Liverpool, yes. Jan. You can just imagine. Yeah. You could just imagine. And we do it with joy, because we realise that, you know, if we weren't listening to those people, we'd be mugs.
Mm.
Jan, one of the interesting things for us also is how we build on what ECTs have learnt in their IT year. So if you were going to give us some advice on that, what would your advice be in terms of what you think ECTs really need in their next 2 years of teaching?
I mean, I suppose coming back to what I said previously, I think what they need is very personalised and, in secondary anyway, very subject specific. And in primary, often curriculum specific too. So, you know, our primary students will leave here feeling very confident teaching certain subjects and not at all confident in teaching others. And what they would really value is an opportunity to gain more knowledge and understanding and practical experience of teaching the curriculum subjects that they feel are less strong for them. Secondary, want to keep developing as subject specialists. And again, I think, you know, the early career framework makes that quite tricky because, you know, they might want to go on a course with the English and Media Centre, for instance, if they're an English and Media specialist, but the school will say, well, you can't do that because we haven't got any money for that. But here's your ECF training, which is not subject specific. So, and I know it is made subject specific by mentors, but, you know, I suppose I would just come back to the fact that that's not the framework, that's quality mentoring. And I mean, I've read a lot of the evaluations of the early career framework. Mentoring comes out really positively in all circumstances, and that's because the mentors are hugely brilliant, largely in what they do, and undervalued in the education system and underpaid for what they do. And we're going to run out of them. You know, there aren't enough of them. So, you know, that's a kind of issue. So I think the other thing is around really taking into account the context. So that they take on a new job in. So it may be that they take on a new job in a school that they've already worked in, but it may be that they take on a job in a school that's completely different to either of the placements that they've had previously. The primary students might be in a year group that they've never taught. So I think it's about, you know, bespoke as much as possible, bespoke training with a lot of networking, because actually, we all remember, I think, the value of that kind of collegial experience of going through teacher training. You know, it's an emotional roller coaster, and doing it alongside other people is really helpful. And I suppose one of the things that NQTs or ECTs can suffer from is feeling isolated if they're the only person in their school that's an ECT. Mm-hmm. So it's a massive bonus to be able to bring them all together and for them to be a mutual support group. I would have built in to early career development a lot more opportunities for them to visit other schools and to visit each other and to co-teach and to observe each other. And because that's, again, one of the real privileges I feel I've had working in ITE. I've been to so many schools and you learn so much from that experience. And it's very good for getting rid of any kind of assumptions or prejudices you might have about what schools are going to be like. So, you know, more of that, I think, would be ideal.
Great advice again, Jan. Yeah, this thing about school visits, it's funny you mentioned that because that is a part of our program. Again, it happens quite late in the program, but we do build an opportunity for them to make a couple of school visits, learning actually from what we know that happens typically in ITE experience, you know, going for a contrasting placement, like that notion. Mm-hmm. We think it's really important. We think it's important that they have a kind of community as well, which is why they do. They have clusters. We put them, they're in clusters and they work with people in the same phase. Sometimes if our partners are large enough, they can also make those more subject specific. That can be really helpful. I do think there's a physics teacher somewhere in the south, near the south coast of England, actually, who's the only ECT in his school. He's also the only physics teacher in his school. And I think about that guy quite a lot. Mm-hmm. when we put the program together, when we improve the program, when we think about the support that he can get. And it never feels like enough, actually. A bit like when you're teaching, you never feel you're doing quite enough for the class in front of you. Mm-hmm. I think that's what we think, that's what Elaine and I bring to this, is that we're kind of constantly ambitious to make it that little bit better. And that's why conversations like this really matter. I've got a question for you, Jan, which is, what keeps you going?
I mean, I think I'm going less than I was because I'm now part time. But I think, you know, fundamentally for me, it's the importance of teaching, you know, and as the kind of, as the root of all things. And you know, yeah, you know, and it's so important that we get a fantastic teacher workforce out there, and that we keep them happy, and that they stay in teaching. And I think, you know, that's a number of factors. I mean, pay is certainly part of it. You know, as I say, as a parent of a teacher and living in London, you know, I'm only too aware of that. And actually, I think it's pay progression that's now the problem. I don't think it's the starting salary that's the problem, it's pay progression. You know, because she's watching her peers that left university at the same time as she did, jumping up the salary, you know, by moving from job to job. Whereas they all started at about the same place, they're not at all in the same place now. And London's expensive, as you know. But a lot of it is job satisfaction, you know, and I prefer the term job satisfaction to work-life balance, because I think that automatically kind of skews teaching in ways that other professions aren't thought about. It's about job satisfaction, you know, and part of that is how it impacts on your life outside of work. But so, you know, I think job satisfaction is massive. And I think, you know, the enjoyment of teaching and of working alongside colleagues, you know, that it's interesting that the students of ours that leave and stay in the schools that they're in, when you ask them why, it's often about the people they teach with, not the people they teach. You know, they like them too, but it's their colleagues. And I think that, again, that's kind of overlooked a bit. That
it's the staff room, isn't it?
Yeah, it is the staff room. It is.
You know, that's what the podcast is called, and there's no accident.
It is, and getting that right. I think if I was a head teacher, that's what I would be focusing on. You know, and you, because you retain people if they would rather stay where they are than move somewhere else, and that's, you know, that a lot of that is about the people that they're working with, and how supported they feel. Not just by the senior staff, actually, but by each other, you know, and by all of the kind of ancillary staff and everybody that, how everybody's treated in a school, I think makes a big difference to how long people want to stay there.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Jan, and I really like what you said about the term satisfaction rather than work-life balance. I think that reframes your thinking slightly about it in a really helpful way.
Just as you finished that sentence, I heard a bell ring, because we are in a school staff room, Jan, believe it or not, and that bell is telling us that we've come to the end of our time on this podcast. We're hugely grateful for you just, you know, spending the time with us in the staff room. Elaine and I have been busy writing notes. We'll be re-watching this and re-listening to this for the advice you gave us and gave the rest of the profession and the DfE along the way. Our thanks go to Jan Rowe, Strategic Partnership Development Lead at Liverpool John Moores University, for sharing a strong coffee and a ginger nut with us this week in the ECF staff room.
Please do get in touch with us if you'd like to talk about your ECF experience. We especially want to hear from a range of voices. And lastly, we hope you'll join us next time for a biscuit and a chat with another colleague in the ECF staff room.
Thanks so much for downloading and listening to this IOE podcast.